This is the Saturday Night Live 31st Day of Sobriety Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on July the 15th, 2000. Our speaker is Pearl N. of Fountain Valley, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
And I'm Pearl Noble, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pearl.
And I want to thank Mickey for inviting me up here to talk to people. And what was a special treat for me, she mailed me a flyer, but when she invited me up here, she told me there was a man by the name of Keith who's going to be speaking, and I know that Keith, and so I was looking forward to seeing him again. And then when I got up here, she told me it was a different Keith, that the other Keith had a... But it's really nice to see and Sally here, because that was like a special surprise for me. They're sort of down from our area, too, and I hadn't seen them. Anyway, the first thing I should tell you about myself is my sponsor's from Texas, and they have a saying in Texas, if you don't share your sobriety date, it's probably because you don't have one. My sobriety date is January 28, 1991, and for that I'm forever grateful. She also taught me I need three things to be a member in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need a sobriety date, I gave you that. You need a sponsor, and my sponsor is a lady by the name of Polly P. And you need a home group, and my home group is the Monday night Seal Beach Speakers Meeting, and I go there every Monday night. And when I got here today, I saw a lot of stuff in seats or flyers and things, and I thought, gee, these people are just like our meeting. We're sort of territorial there. You know, we get there early, we save our seat, and so we can stake out our territory. I sit in the same seat, second row, third seat in every Monday night, and the meeting starts at 7, and I don't get there till 3:30 to get my seat. It's a wonderful group I belong to, and I hope you people feel the same way about your group. Our group feels very strongly about sponsorship, and I should tell you my sponsor has a sponsor, and her sponsor is Dottie H. And on Monday night, I sit with Polly over here and Dottie over here, and I know I'm in good company. You know, they're just not going to let me slip either way. Next thing I should tell you is I'm really glad you invited me up here. A few years ago, a very good friend of mine that lived down there by me, we did a lot of stuff together. She moved up here to San Jose. So every time I get to come up to San Jose, I get to spend some time with Pam. And I really miss her. And it's really good to come up here. And it was nice to get off the airplane today and see Mickey and Pam waiting for me. I didn't know Pam was going to be there, and that was special. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I got here at the end of the other speakers, and I guess you're from the Midwest. I, too, am from the Midwest. I was born on a little farm in central Illinois. And, my dad had the farm. We had the farm, let me put it that way, because, you see, my father was an alcoholic. But I never got to see my father drink, and I never saw him drunk because he got sober when I was about 2 years old. And he... He passed away when I was 87 days sober, and he had almost 50 years of sobriety. And I should tell you, the only thing my father ever wanted for his daughter was for her to stop drinking. I can tell you that. He really didn't mind the 2:30 a.m. calls. He took them. He listened to me, and he didn't always hang up. Sometimes he did, and sometimes I think he just put the phone down, because sometimes I would scream and there'd be like nobody there. But I should tell you that what he wanted for me was just for me to sober up. My mother passed away a couple years ago, and she was 86 years old, and my mother had 86 years of sobriety. And she never let us forget that one either. So that's the kind of home I was born and raised in. I'm from a large family. I have four older brothers and two younger sisters, and we lived on this farm, and I don't remember too much about it because I think my mother got sort of tired of doing the work, because even after my dad got sober, I don't think he was too functional for a while. And so she sold the farm one day and moved us into the city. And I understand that that's the kind of woman she was. And my father never went to Alcoholics Anonymous because when he got sober, there weren't any meetings around. And I remember I asked him once why he did. And I hadn't been to AA yet, didn't understand too much about it. And he said because Mom made him quit drinking. And she looked at him sort of funny. And he said, one Christmas Eve, she said to him, Ed, if you wake up tomorrow morning drunk, I'm taking the kids and I'm going. And now my mom said she said that a lot. My dad said when she said it that night, he knew she meant it. and he didn't drink again. And he got very involved in his church and community and doing things like that. So, you know, when I was a little girl growing up, I never saw him drink, but he loved to tell his stories. My dad had some wonderful stories. And I was a kid growing up, and I came to AA, and I found out some of you people had alcoholic parents, and you didn't want to be anything at all like your parents. Well, I got to tell you, when I was growing up and I heard my dad's stories, I wanted to be just like my dad. And I grew up to be just like my dad. You know, my dad was a traveling drunk. He liked to drink and travel or travel and drink, and it didn't matter in which order he did it. My favorite story was on a Friday night after they had finished with their chores, you know, he and his brother went into town to have a couple of beers. That's all they were going to do, just have a couple of beers. And this is in central Illinois, and they both came to 2 weeks later in Fresno, California, members of the United States Navy, and they hadn't a clue how they got there. I love that story. And my mother made my dad quit telling me the stories because, see, I was the only one of those seven kids that laughed. And I should also tell you, I'm the only one of those seven kids who's an alcoholic. So I grew up in this family, and from the get-go, I was irritable and discontent. I didn't fit in. I knew I didn't fit in, and I was trying to convince that family I didn't fit in. And I was absolutely convinced as a child that probably I was adopted. I just didn't seem to fit in. And it wasn't until I got sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized that I came from one of the most loving, warm families. And my problem was there just never was enough. Nothing was enough. You didn't have enough love for me. And what I found out was something my younger sister had been telling me all my life. My problem was I was spoiled rotten. You see, because I told you I come from a big family, but what I had was four older brothers. I was the first daughter. I was the first granddaughter on both sides of the family. I was the first niece, and I was the first baby sister, and I was spoiled rotten. I didn't have to do a thing. My two younger sisters did, but I didn't. But it just wasn't enough, and I was a pouty kind of child, you know, the kind of child that pouts a lot, and somebody was always saying as I was growing up, "What's the matter with Pearl?" And my parents would, you know, like shrug their shoulders. And then when I got older, you know, people would say, "What's the matter, Pearl?" And I'd say, "Nothing." And then they'd say, "Come on, Pearl, tell me what's the matter." And I'd say, "Nothing." And then they would say, "Come on, tell us what's the matter." And I'd say, "Nothing is the matter. And would you please just leave me alone?" And they did. And then I knew what the matter was. You see, I knew they didn't love me or they would have hung around. You know, they split. So anyway, I grew up all my life knowing two things from my father and my mother. You know, I wasn't going to be an alcoholic. I wanted to do some of the things my dad did, but I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because he didn't talk about it like it was a very great thing to do. And, of course, my mother didn't. And I knew from hearing my mother talk about it that I certainly was not going to marry one. Not going to do either one of those things. So what happened was I had to leave that. I split when I was 16, and I got a scholarship to go to the University of Arizona, and I've only been back for visits since. It just worked out that way. So anyway, I'm out here at the University of Arizona, and I met this guy, and we went out on a date. And the first red light, he popped open the glove compartment of the car, pulled out a pint of vodka, reached under the seat, pulled out the orange juice, and asked me if I'd like to have a drink. And with all the arrogance I could muster up, I looked him straight in the eye, and I told him, "I don't drink. And I don't go with guys who do." And 6 months later, we were married. So I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking at an early age. I had my first drink when I was 28 years old. And I was 28 years old, and I had everything in my life going exactly the way I wanted it. When I was that little girl growing up, I wanted to get married, have a family, and teach school. I thought that would just be what would make me happy. At 28 years of age, I'm married, I have three sons, I'm living in a little town in Florida, and I'm teaching school, and I have everything just really great. And I don't know what happened that day. It was probably not a day any different than any other day, but I went home from school that day, and there was alcohol in our house, so I just poured a glass of scotch and drank it. I don't know anything about mixing drinks, and I don't know what you're supposed to do, but I poured the glass of scotch and I drank it, and I must have done it a lot that night, because I had my first drink, my first drunk. I blacked out. I came to the next morning with a hangover, and I called in sick to school, and I swore I'd never do it again, and I didn't. I never called in sick again. I learned to function with hangovers. I learned to function half drunk, and I thought I was about the best thing going after I had a few drinks. And actually, alcohol was very good. I told you I was like that restless little kid, and when I began drinking, alcohol calmed that restlessness. I felt better. I just felt better. I didn't feel fantastic. I didn't feel like I could conquer the world. Everything was okay. When I drank, everything was okay. I felt better, and people seemed to treat me better. And if they didn't, I didn't notice. You know, and I don't think I started out drinking to blackouts, but my best memories of my drinking was it happened rather quickly. And I drank for a lot of years. And I just, that was just one of the prices you pay. You know, if you want to feel good and get calmed down and get relaxed, one of the prices you have to pay is just to have a little hangover. And actually, I got used to the hangovers, and I didn't always have a hangover, and I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always black out until the last few years of my drinking. Then I always blacked out. And, you know, and I was like an at-home drinker. I told you I started drinking in that little town in Florida, and I was a school teacher. And when I taught school, it was not good for a teacher to be seen in a bar drinking. It was so bad, in fact, in this little town of Florida, that if you were seen in a bar drinking, you were immediately asked for your resignation. So I learned very early that I had to do my drinking at home. I was not to go to bars. I could drink at other people's houses, and I could do that sort of thing, but I could not drink in this wonderful little southern community in Florida and be a school teacher. So I did my drinking at home, and I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out what I'd missed. Because that's all I did. You know, I just sat on my couch and drank. Actually, I told you I liked to be like my dad. My dad was a traveling drunk, and by the time we moved to California, I had a wonderful opportunity. My husband went to work for a major airline, an overseas carrier, and I got a wonderful benefit from him working for that airline. I got what they call an airline lingo, a P1 pass. That means positive space, first class. And I learned to fly anywhere I wanted to go. That meant when I showed up at the airport, those people had to put me on a seat and take care of me. That's all I knew. And if I'd get bored and restless and discontent in that little house down there in Fountain Valley in Orange County, I'd just pick up my passport and a suitcase, and I'd either pack it or not pack it. It didn't matter. I wasn't staying anywhere. I was going somewhere. You know, I'm a goer. I may not be a stayer. I'm a goer. I like going. I just like going. And I knew I had been around long enough to know that when you get on those airplanes, you better look like a tourist. You better have a piece of luggage and something. I was the type of person that always had to feel like I belonged. And if I went to the airport, I better have a piece of luggage. And so I'd take that piece of luggage, and they'd tell us to stow it, and I'd stow my luggage, and I was one of everybody else. And when you fly first class, they start you on the ground with a little thing they call a mimosa. I became a good mimosa drinker. I could drink them fast and get two or three before we got off. Then the flight would take off, and they'd come around, and they'd ask you what you like to have to drink. Well, I always liked what they had. You know, it really didn't matter to me what it was, but I would sort of look, and whatever it seemed to me that they had the most bottles of, that's what I asked for. You know, that's just the way it was. And, you know, I know it takes 9 hours to get to Tokyo. It takes 9 hours to get to any of those countries in Europe. It takes 14 hours to get to New Zealand and Australia and Tahiti and all those wonderful places. And I know because I went to those places. And so what I'd do is I'd get on those airplanes, and I'd stow my luggage and have my mimosa and then start drinking and fly to wherever the plane was flying. And I'd get off the airplane, and I'd go into the little gift shop, and I'd get these little postcards. You know, when you're traveling, you got to send postcards. Got to look like a good traveler. And I'd send them, and I'd say a little something like, saw this today, tell you about it when I get back. You know, or having a great time. And it takes 6 hours to refuel that airplane and get those seat belts crossed in the X and get that thing gassed up and going up. And 6 hours later, I'm back on that airplane. I'm heading home. I told you I wasn't staying anywhere. I don't know. Do they call that binge drinking? Anyway, I knew that I was safe up there. You can't get in trouble 30,000 feet in the air strapped in. I never did. You know, you just drink until you go out, and then you come to and you drink again on the long part. On those long flights, I could go in and out two or three times. And I'd get back home, and I'd tell my friends I was going someplace, and of course then they weren't expecting to hear from me for a while, so about 3 or 4 days later I'd give them a call and tell them I'm back. Did you get my postcard yet? And you know, things like that. We just talk, and they just assumed I stayed down there. And I sort of associated a lot of times with other airline people. And Pam and I have this kindred thing because she was with the airline for a long time too, and she was probably one of those attendants giving it to me whenever I was doing it. But anyway, you know how you have these parties and you do this one-upsmanship drinking. I always wanted to do the best. You know, I always had to have something bragging. I think alcoholics always have to have bragging rights. So. I decided I was going to have the biggest, farthest away, longest drunk. So that's what I did. I got my passport and my piece of luggage, and I went down to LAX, and I flew around the world. I got on that airplane at LAX, and it had one of those round-the-world flights. You could go westerly, and then you could go to New York, and you could go easterly. I did it both ways. But I started here the first time I did it, and I went down to LAX, and it flew from there to Tokyo, and I drank in Tokyo. I mean, you have to drink in all the places you go to if you're going to get a story. And it went from there to Hong Kong, and I drank in Hong Kong. And then it went from there to Bangkok, and I drank in Bangkok. And then I think it went to... we went to Tehran. Not allowed to have drinking in Tehran. They don't drink there, except if you're an airline employee, they tell you where the bottle is. And so I got to drink in Tehran. And then from Tehran, you know, I went to New Delhi, and then from New Delhi we went to Frankfurt, and from Frankfurt we went to San Francisco, to London, and San Francisco, and home, and I was back home in 7 days. And I told all my friends I flew around the world, and I drank in all those countries. At the airports. I never left the airports. It stood for a long time, you know, as the drunk. And, you know, about this time, shortly after that little episode, my husband got transferred to the East Coast. Now, I'm living out here in California, and I sort of like it out here in California. I sort of like the warm weather, but he got transferred to the East Coast, and that company's main headquarters was out in New York, so he moved me into Connecticut. And by this time, my sons are grown, and a couple of them are married, and one's off studying for a doctorate, and they're sort of gone and out of the house. And so we moved to Stamford, Connecticut, and my drinking accelerated. And I still didn't go to bars. I still did my drinking at home, and I stayed home. He moved me in that house there in Connecticut, and I just stayed there. Connecticut's wonderful. Well, I don't know too much about Connecticut. I didn't see too much of it, but Connecticut's great because all you have to do in Connecticut is pick up the phone and order, and they bring it to your door. You can't buy it in the grocery stores, though. I found that out my first Sunday. I ran out, and I'm going down the grocery store, and it's like, I've just come from California, and you can buy it any place in California, and I hightail it to the grocery store. Whew, they don't even have it in the grocery stores. And then I looked over at the beer counter, and they have this tarp down over it. They can't sell it on Sunday. Probably my worst Sunday of my life. You know, I had to go home and root around through that house. You know, there wasn't that much there. And I had to make the most of what I had. And I just went to bed early that night and got up early the next morning and went down to the liquor store and stocked up. And I always had to stock up because I was scared to death it was going to be a Sunday again. You know, so I just called there. And what I should tell you is when a person drinks like that, the marriage has got to bite the dust. You know, there's only so much understanding and so much care that a person can give. And besides, we were drinking right along with each other. And, you know, you just can't have two people in the house doing this. You know, I didn't have any energy for anything by this time. I didn't care to do anything. My primary purpose was drinking, and that's what I was doing. By this time, I'm drinking almost 24 hours a day, and that's what I do. You know, my husband would come home from work and one more time start this, "What's the matter with you, Pearl?" And one day I came out of a little blackout type thing, and I saw this, and I think it might have been a soap opera, I don't really know, and they were talking about agoraphobia. Now, I've been in Connecticut for a year and a half, and I've hardly been out of my house. I find out you can even order groceries, so I'm ordering my groceries, I'm ordering everything in, I'm not leaving the house very much, except to go to the airport and fly. But the taxi picks you up at the door. You don't have to do all that on your own. They had this thing about agoraphobia. Now, agoraphobia is where you fear leaving your house. So my husband came home one night and just one more time asked me what was the matter with me. And I told him I had agoraphobia. I don't think he bought it. But anyway, you know, when you drink like that, the marriage has got to bite the dust. It's got to go. It's getting in the way. It was getting in the way. I didn't have any energy to take care of that marriage. I didn't care about taking care of that marriage because the one thing that alcohol stripped me of was my ability to care. I didn't care about anything except the next drink, where it was coming from, and if it was going to be enough. And that was my only concern. And I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hear people talk a lot about what alcohol took away from them. And I've got to tell you, alcohol didn't take anything away from me. I gave it freely. I gave that 30-year marriage freely. We had talked several times about my stopping drinking. And I've got to tell you, I chose the bottle. I chose the bottle, and I made that decision. And I knew that marriage was going to be over. But you know, I'm pretty good. I'm one of those people who know the answers to everything, whether I know them or not. I'm going to tell you what they are. But I had this older brother, and he was, after my father passed away, you know, he was sort of like he was my big friend, he was my father, he was my brother, and he was my everything. And when I told him I was getting a divorce, he told me I was going to need to get a lawyer, so I did. And I regretted it for a minute, because what happened when I walked in the lawyer's office was she asked me if I drank. And I assured her I did. I said, you know, I have a glass of wine or two on occasion. You know, no big deal here. She suggested that I not drink. She picked up on something there. Because she said, you know, Pearl, I don't know you. I don't know anything about you. And you're coming off a 30-year marriage, and I got to represent you, so I don't want you drinking. And I didn't. And that divorce took 6 months, a lot longer than what we had anticipated. 30-year marriage doesn't just go away overnight. And I didn't drink for 6 months. And I knew then that I was not an alcoholic, because I knew that an alcoholic couldn't go 6 months without drinking. I knew that. You know, I was crazy. I was nutty. Now, I told you this happened in Connecticut, and when the divorce was over, I planned to come back out to California. Fortunately, we had kept our house out here. I don't know why I insisted, but I absolutely insisted we not sell our house out here. That I was told him at the time I was just going there temporarily, and it turned out to be true. So I couldn't wait to get back to California, but I had to wait till it was all over. And the day that the attorney called me and told me it was all over, you know, I could go home. She said, every paper has been signed. You don't even have to go to court. I'll do that for you. You can go back to California now, Pearl. And I took a 7 a.m. flight out of JFK out here to California, and I packed all that luggage, and we fought over a portable television set, and so now I'm sitting on that airplane with a portable television set on my lap. It's 7 a.m., and the cabin attendant comes around and asks me if I'd like to have a drink. And you betcha, I'm 6 months thirsty. And I told her yes. And she said, what would you like? And I said, I really don't care, but just make it a stiff one. And after we took off, she came back, and she had a water glass about this big. And I asked her what it was, and she said it was a perfect martini. Huh? You know what a perfect martini is? You fill a water glass full of gin, you lean over it, you say vermouth, and you chug-a-lug. And I got to tell you, martinis became my drink of choice, because that gin just did the job. It did the job fast. And that became my drink of choice after I got to California, until it got me into trouble. I was sitting in my house and there in Fountain Valley, minding my own business, and the doorbell rang, and I looked out that little peephole, and there was two of Fountain Valley's finest in their most wonderful blue uniforms standing out there. And I'm living alone now, and I talk to myself a lot, so I told myself not to answer the door. I don't need to be talking to any cops right now. And so I didn't. But I told you I'm a blackout drinker, and the next thing I remember, I'm sitting there in my living room, and I'm negotiating with these two cops. You know, they want me to go with them, and I don't want to go. And I'm explaining that I'm in my own home, minding my own business, and I don't need to go with them. And they're explaining that they could either take me nicely or not so nicely. And so I went. You know, I mean, what do you do? So I got down there, and they wanted to call some members of the family. And I told them I didn't have any family, because I'm not going to get my kids wrapped up in this thing. You know, I've done enough to those kids. I've terrorized them enough. You know, I'm one of those people who believes that alcoholism is probably one of the few diseases that kill people who don't even have it. Because if you're a parent like me, you get to watch your children die right in front of you. What again, Mom? Can't make it again, Mom? Oh, Mom. You know, and you're watching your kids die, you watch a marriage die. So it's a killer disease, and it kills people who don't even drink. And so I'm not going to get my kids involved in this thing, and I'm not going to get any of my friends involved in it. So I told them, I don't have any family, and I don't have any friends, and if you just take me back home, I will be good, and I promise I'll never call them again. Because at that point, I'm a blackout drinker. I figured I called them. I call a lot of people when I'm drinking. You know, I got a lot of good ideas after I've been drinking for a while, and I need to tell people about my good ideas. You know, so I thought, well, maybe I called them with a good idea. I don't know. So I'm sitting there, and I think I've got them convinced that they're going to take me back home and everything's going to be cool. What I found out later was I had them convinced they were going to take me to a place in California they call Metropolitan State Hospital. And so finally, you know, we're negotiating and arguing, and finally about that time a young man walked by the door, and he was one of our neighbors, and he grew up and became a policeman. And he walked by, and he said, "Hi, Miss Noble, how are you? What are you doing here, and how are your boys?" sort of blew my cover there, and of course, you know what happened. One of those policemen split, and the next thing I know, my youngest son is down there at that police station going to take care of his mom. And I think that was the night that I hadn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know the words, but I think that was the first time I felt that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I'm sitting there in that chair, and that young son's coming to pick his mom up to take her home, and that young son's a policeman for the city of Irvine. I think when he took me home that night, I promised him I wouldn't drink any more gin. That's the way I rationalized it out. And I didn't, after I finished off the supply I already had. Don't pour it away. You know, you do not get rid of booze. You know, you just don't. So I drank the rest of that gin, and then I turned my life and my will over to wine, white wine. It's a ladies' drink. You know, ladies can drink white wine. You have to get a good wine, and you have to have a lot of it. And I, after some exploring and testing, I found the perfect wine. Gallo by the gallon. You drink it by the gallon and you buy it by the case. You stack it right here beside your couch, and so you don't have to go very far. You know, and that's just the way it is. And so I began drinking that wine. And you know, all the time I was doing that, I was trying to figure out a way I could, like, make a big straw. So I could get that straw and just, and I wouldn't have to move. I could just lay there and drink it. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I met this young kid, and he worked in a pizza parlor. And he said what he did was, the only reason he worked in a pizza parlor was because he had these big wine dispensers. And he'd go to, every time he'd go by the wine dispenser, he'd just put his mouth underneath there and go, shoop. And I thought, cool, I should have gone to work in a pizza parlor. You know, it would have solved all my problems. You know, so, you know, I'm drinking this Gallo by the gallon now, and that's all I'm doing. Because I can't eat anymore. I don't know. I'm not hungry. I'm not hungry. The wine is filling me up. I was talking to Pam today, and I said I'm beginning to gain weight. You know, I was pretty small. And you know, when you're my size and you drink the amount of alcohol that I was drinking, you only have room inside your stomach for one thing: food or alcohol. No decision. That's a no-brainer. You know, give up the food. So I don't eat. I probably didn't eat for my last 3 years of drinking. Well, once in a while I'd go to Der Wiener Schnitzel and get one of their little chili dogs. And that microwave popcorn came in handy a few times. You know, but, and when you don't eat, you don't have trash. You don't have anything to throw in the trash can except wine bottles. About this time, a little thing called paranoia is beginning to creep in on me. I'm concerned about the garbage man all of a sudden, and I'm convinced that the garbage man is counting my wine bottles, and I can't have that happening. I can't have the garbage man telling my neighbors I'm drinking wine, that much wine. And so I thought it was creative until I got here and found out a lot of you folks did it too. Wait till your neighbors go to bed and put it in their garbage can. That worked for a while until I realized that the neighbors were probably watching me too. Everybody's watching me now. I can't do much of anything because the neighbors are watching and the garbage man is watching. And one day I'm driving out of my little subdivision there, and the church is doing some renovations, and they got those dumpsters. You know how they line up dumpsters in the parking lot? And that's cool. So now I'm waiting until after dark, about every fourth day, and I'm dumping those wine bottles in the church dumpster. Except I know the priest is watching. You know, and now I'm going to get into trouble with the church, you know. First of all, I'm in trouble with garbage man and my neighbors, and now I'm doing it to the church. You know, I'm just doing it to the church. And about that time, a friend of mine called me up, and she wanted to enroll in college. She wanted to go to Orange Coast College down there where we live, and she had never been to college, and she was scared, and she knew I'd been to college, and so she called up and asked me if I'd help her register. And of course, you know, it was early in the morning. I'm okay early in the morning. Told her I'd meet her over there about 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and that's cool. I can meet her there. Better the morning meeting than an afternoon meeting. I don't do afternoon meetings too well. I've always overshot the mark by that time. And so I met her over there, and as I pulled in that parking lot, you know, lined with dumpsters all up and down the parking lot. So I help her enroll in college, and we walked away from there, and I'm signed up for 4 8 a.m. classes. And she said to me, "What are you going back for?" And I said, "I think I need some refresher courses." She said, "Why? You're not even working." And I said, "Well, I may have to someday. It's a good thing I took those refresher courses because I had to go to work." Those refresher courses were in basic spelling, aerobics, just wonderful classes like that. I should tell you I'm an auditor today. They didn't do me a bit of good. So anyway, I sign up for those classes, and so I'm dumping my wine bottles every morning on the way to class in the dumpster. And I don't know about your campuses up here, but they have campus police down there. And they come around those little tiny, like, mail cart things, and they check people out all day long. And I'm parking in the same spot every morning because I'm getting there at the same time, and this guy's coming by, and I know he's watching me put my wine bottles in the trash can. So got to think of something else, and I did. And this one worked until the end of my drinking. It was the master thought. What I did was my young son came over one Sunday, and I had him build this thing for me. It was about the size of a podium, and it, like, lifted up, and it had a hinge on one side. And so I'd put it right next to the trash can. And what I'd do is I'd take those wine bottles and I'd smash them all up and then dump the little stuff, the broken glass, down into the thing. And if you do that, if you go out and drink, be sure you get the necks, because garbage men count necks. So I'd have to smash up the necks and everything and get them over there. And I was okay. I did that perfect till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, about this time, you know, my kids aren't coming around much anymore, and because you know, all I'm doing is drinking. And, you know, they pop in on Mom once in a while just to see if she's doing okay. But, you know, they're not staying. You know, they're just sort of popping in and out. And I love to see those kids. I love my children very much, but I love to see them go too, because, you know, I don't drink in front of my kids. And so they can't stay too long. And if they came for dinner, they don't get dessert. I forgot to make it. Sorry, kids. And I have to get them out of there. And if they don't come, we had a rule, you have to call first. Don't just pop in on Mom. I may be entertaining. Sure. And so they would call and say, Mom, we're going to stop by. And I'd go down to the grocery store and I'd get fresh fruit and I'd fill up the fruit bowl and I'd buy a steak and I'd put it here on the counter. And if they questioned, I'd say, I'm thawing it for dinner. If they weren't coming for a meal, you know, I was thawing it. And I'd have milk in the refrigerator and bread. And because I thought they were always checking my house out. They weren't. But anyway, I had it all set so that it looked like Mom was doing okay. And a week later, I threw all that stuff in the junk. Trash man had a good day that day, you know, when they came to visit. I mean, I didn't eat the stuff. I just, after it rotted, I threw it away. Last Thanksgiving, I fixed them turkey on Thanksgiving. We had a wonderful dinner. And the next Wednesday, I threw the carcass off the dining room table away. You know, it was, that was the kind of drinking that I did. You know, once they left, I was gone. I was out of there. This one Monday morning on February 13th, 1989, I got a telephone call from that same friend that I had helped enroll in college, and we'd been friends for about 18 years, and my friends were not inviting me to go around with them anymore. The kids weren't coming around that much anymore. I really didn't have any kind of life, and that was okay. Drinking was what I did, and she called me this day, and she sounded like she was in a heap of hurt, and she needed some help. And so she called, and she asked if she could come over, and she had something she needed to talk to me about. And, you know, I don't have that many friends anymore, and if my best friend's in a lot of trouble, you know, I'm gonna help her through it. So I told her, sure, come on over, and, you know, I got ready for talking to her. The only way I know how to get ready for anything in my life, you know, I chug-a-lugged about a half a jug of that wine, and she came over, and she walked into my house, and she gave me a hug, and she told me she loved me. And we had known each other for 18 years, and she never once gave me a hug and told me she loved me, but she did that day. And we sat down on the couch, and then she asked me the dumbest question, you know. She asked me if I had a problem with alcohol, and I assured her I did not. You know, I told her I did not have any problems at all with alcohol. But she stayed and talked for a long time that day, and I don't remember all of that, but the feeling I got was I better agree to do anything she suggests because I really need her as a friend. And so she asked me if I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with her. And I told you my father was an alcoholic, but he never went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I hadn't a clue what it was about. So I told her, yeah, I'll go. She said, well, I'm going to leave now, Pearl. She said, I want you to call. It's listed in the phone book. And she said, I want you to call central office and see where there's a meeting tonight. And as she got to the door, she turned around and she said to me, Pearl, are you going to call or should I? I don't know about you, but I did a lot of lying. In fact, I lied more than I told the truth, and I lied when the truth was probably the best thing to do and the easiest thing to do, but I just spent a lifetime lying. And that day, for some reason, I said to her, if you don't, I won't. And that was reality. If I would not call Alcoholics Anonymous and find out where there's a meeting, why? Why would I do that? So she left and she called me a little while later and she said, Pearl, there's a meeting in a place called Howe Hall in Huntington Beach tonight at 8 o'clock. Be ready at 7. I'm going to be by to pick you up. And I was. And I took a nap. And then I got up and I got ready for that meeting the way I got ready for anything. You know, I chug-a-lug some more of that wine, and it's February 13th. It's raining. It's cold. It's miserable and nasty outside. And she came to pick me up, and so I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk, real drunk. And we get there, and it was a big room about this size, and every seat was taken. And they called it a newcomers meeting, and I found out later they call it a newcomers meeting because there may have been 120-plus people in that room, but 100 of them were newcomers, always newcomers. So anyway, we went into that meeting that night, and my friend's sitting right over here, and she did a lot of elbowing that night, as I recall. And they got up at a podium like this, and the person who was running the group got up here and asked if there was any newcomers, and she elbowed me. And I sort of gave her a dirty look. And about that time, about half the room stood up, and they all gave their name and said they were an alcoholic. And I thought, huh, that's what we're supposed to do. So I stood up, and I said, I'm Pearl, and I'm an alcoholic. And she got a smile on her face. And I sat back down. And that was good. And a little while later, you know, they went around the room and they identified, and everybody had to say their name and say there's an alcoholic. And that night, I got so mad at my friend. I just copped a resentment here. You know, I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that she made me go to. She made me tell him I was an alcoholic. When it got to her, she didn't tell him she was an alcoholic. And that made me mad. Real mad. And we left that meeting that night. We went to Coco's and had a cup of coffee, and I confronted her on it, boy. I said, you know, you made me tell those people in that room that I'm an alcoholic, and you didn't tell them you were one. And she said, Pearl, I'm not. She said, Pearl, 6 years ago, my father died in an alcoholic seizure. And my oldest son has 1 year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been an active member of Al-Anon for 15 years. Thank you, Sally. Sally's one of my favorite Al-Anons, and I love it when I go to a meeting and I know there's an Al-Anon there, because you see, it was an Al-Anon that saved my life. I didn't know that, any of that stuff about my friend. We had been friends for a long time. I did not know any of that stuff about my friend. I knew her sons, and I knew pretty much what she did. We played golf together a lot. We played a lot of bridge together, and we did a lot of shopping together, and we did a lot of luncheon together. And I asked her later, I said, how do you know I had a drinking problem? And she said, do you remember that day we went to that little Chinese restaurant, and they had that awful plum wine? I said, yeah. As I recall, they brought the plum wine. You sipped it. I drank it. And I said to you, would you like to have some more? And she said, no, this stuff tastes awful. And I said, well, what do we care? And I drank it. You know, she said she knew then that I probably had a problem with alcohol. Plus, I was getting to the point where I wasn't showing up. You know how your friends will call and ask you to go something, you say, yeah, 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 right. And then you got to call them right before it happens and tell them you got the flu. Or you've been called out of town on an emergency. You know, all those kind of things. And I was beginning to do all those kind of things with her. At one point that evening, I said to her, I don't belong here. Would you please take me home? And she said, no. She was brutal about the way she said no. Actually, what she really said was, Pearl, why don't you just sit there and shut up and listen for a change? And that made me mad, too. But we did. And, you know, from that very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous has been there for me. From that very first meeting, you know, I walked in that room, and those people, they gave me cards, and they made me feel a part of. They just did everything for me. And I got to tell you, I was drunk that night, and I didn't hear too much of what went on that night, but I did hear the magic. I heard the magic that night because I heard some words that I hadn't heard in a long time, and I heard some words that sounded like a direct order, and I heard some words that I knew applied to me. And it was just three words that I heard. It seemed to me that everybody that got up this podium and talked said those same three words, and those were the only three words I heard with regularity that night. And I understand there's no newcomers here, but, you know, those words just hit me home. They told me to keep coming back. And everybody said it, so I knew I was going to have to do it. I knew deep down I was just going to have to do that. And they told me that night to buy a big book, and I did, and they told me to get a sponsor. And I thought about that one for a while, and I thought, well, I'll delay on that one. I had a clue what a sponsor might be. They're probably going to be somebody to tell you what to do. I don't want to go there just yet. But I bought the big book, and they told me to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And I did. And I went to that. I found out where all the meetings were. People, you'd go to one meeting, and they'd tell you where another meeting was, and another meeting was, and another meeting was. And from that first day, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And as a matter of fact, after about 4 months, I added two meetings. I started going to a morning meeting, a night meeting. You know, and those people, they took me on conventions. They took me to their potlucks. They took me to hear special speakers. They took me everywhere with them. Every place those people went, they threw me in the back seat of the car and took me with them. But for the next 730 days, they asked me to do something that I absolutely could not do. They asked me not to drink between meetings. So for my first 730 days in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went home and got drunk. And then I'd come to the next morning with a hangover, and I'd go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd go home and I'd get drunk. And those people never told me to stay away. They told me to keep coming back. They're crazy. They're crazy. I didn't know. Some of them I didn't believe were sober, you know. Most of them I did. Most of them I did. You know, and people in Alcoholics Anonymous are absolutely fantastic. You stay around here, they're crazy. You know, they gave me commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. Tuesday night meeting elected me secretary. Every Tuesday night they'd ask for newcomers, every Tuesday night my hand's in the air. And I said to them, you know, you guys got to get a new secretary because, I'm drinking. And they said, no, Pearl, we want you to keep it. It may be the one thing that keeps you coming back. And so I kept my job as secretary. And I don't get to go there anymore. Pam and I were talking about it. She asked me if I still went to that meeting. Down our way, they have a beach meeting on Sunday morning from 10 to 12. And what they do is they get out there on the beach and they spread a big parachute around and everybody brings their beach chairs and they sit around there and they have a terrific meeting. And after I was going there for a while, they made me the parachute bringer. It was my job to take that care of that parachute during the week and on Sunday morning show up with that parachute and spread it out there on the sand. And it was my job to do it perfect. And there's a guy that goes to that meeting. His name is Willie. You come to my home group, I'll introduce you to Willie. And Willie told me, because I didn't know exactly where on the sand to put it, and Willie told me to pace off 59 steps from the men's room and put the parachute down there. And if you wanted to see something funny on a Sunday morning, you'd have seen this drunk lady on the beach pacing off 59 steps from the men's room and then spreading out a parachute. And I took pride in all my jobs here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I'm going to do the job the best I can do it. And so that meeting started at 10 o'clock, and some mornings I'm there as early as 8:30 spreading that parachute out to make sure this is absolutely perfect, and the long way had to go this way, and it couldn't go this way. And they did a lot of teasing with me about that parachute. And I've got to tell you another thing now, too. They don't make the people measure off 59 steps in the men's room anymore. I don't know if they ever did. But I'd get there and I'd spread it out perfect. And one July, I came to on a Sunday morning, and it's hot and it's sticky, and I'm in a dirty pair of jeans and a dirty sweatshirt. I had just probably had a chili dog or something, my weekly eating, and I had parted company with it, and it was all over me, and I was a mess. And I looked at my watch, and it's 10:10, and I got to get the parachute down to the beach. So I raced into the bathroom, and I brushed my teeth, and I brushed my hair, and I grabbed that parachute, and I sailed down there at that beach, and it's about 20 minutes away, and I'm 10 minutes late. And when I walked up on that beach that Sunday morning, my absolute worst nightmare came true. Because when I walked up on that beach that morning, there was nobody there. And I'm the kind of person that my head is operating. It's operating full tilt all the time. It tells me stuff. I believe it. Clancy calls it the disease of perception. I don't know. I'm believing it. Because when I walked up on the beach that morning, what my head told me was they had moved the beach, moved the meeting, didn't tell you where it was because they were tired of you coming to their meeting drunk. And so I'm standing on the beach, and I don't know what I'm going to do now. I got the parachute, but I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm standing there, and I'm crying, because where do I go from here? And about that time, a little boy raced up out of the water, and his mother was standing over here to the side, and he ran up there, and he said, Mommy, Mommy, I'm having so much fun today. Can I come back to the beach tomorrow? And she said, No, son. Tomorrow's Sunday. We got to go to church. Yeah, I showed up on the wrong day. And I took that parachute and I got in my car and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I bought a case of that wine And the parachute did not make it to the meeting that Sunday morning. I called in sick. And I think I was out. You know, and those are the kind of things I did. And I told you I started going to a morning meeting. I'm still not sponsored. I'm not going to ask anybody to do that. So, but I figured, a man told me to, you know, people were telling me all the time which new meetings to try. And so they sent me down to Marina Pacifica. And so I'm going down, heading down to Marina Pacifica now. So I'll tell you now what my everyday was like. My everyday was always the same. It became a pattern for me. I don't know about you, but I had a come and to time, and it was 2:30. 2:30 a.m., 2:30 p.m., it didn't matter. Every time it hit 2:30, I got the same thing I got to do. I wake up in the morning at 2:30, and I got to get ready to go to that 7 a.m. meeting. It's up in Long Beach, and it takes me about a half an hour to get there. And I got to get up, and I got to get a shower. Only by this time, the shaking's bad. You know, I'm shaking. I'm shaking real bad, and I can't seem to get the body under control. And the only way I know how to get that body under control is to pop a can of beer. So I pop the can of beer, and I put it above the shower. I take a shower, and I drink the beer. And by the time I finish them both, I got the hand steady enough that I can drive myself to the morning meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I drive down the freeway, and I start praying. You know, God, please let this be the day that they say something that's going to help me stay sober. Because I'm tired and I can't do this much more. You know, and I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the consummate victim. All of my problems were of your creation. If you'd just treat me a little bit better, if you'd be a little bit nicer to me, I wouldn't have had to drink the way I do. So if you were the problem, you had to be the solution. And I'd go there and I'd listen as best I could. And they didn't say it. Whatever it was, they didn't say it. And I'd leave that meeting and I did the same thing I always did before. I'd go home and drink. And then I'd come to and it'd be 2:30 and I got to get ready now for the night meeting. I got to get ready, and I got to do the same thing all over again, because the shakes are back. The shakes are back real bad again. And I get myself ready, and I go to that night meeting, and I sit there, and I stare at the clock, and those meetings there at that time all started at 8 o'clock and all ended at 9:30, and about a quarter after 9, I'm praying again. You know, God, please don't let me stop on the way home tonight for the wine. Because when I started going to two meetings, I quit buying wine in quantity. And so I had to buy it on a daily basis, and I'd start praying, because I knew it might be the day. You know, I kept praying all that time, and this might be the day, and I don't have a bottle of wine in my house. Is this the day I'm going to stop drinking? So, you know, God, don't let me stop for the wine tonight, but I always had to stop for that wine. You know, people would ask me out for a cup of coffee, and I'd tell them, no, I got to go to the grocery store. I need some milk and bread, and every one of them knew that my milk and bread was a jug of Gallo. And so I'd get that Gallo and go home. 1991, they invited me to a sober Super Bowl party. And I used to tell this story, and I used to share that I was the only one drunk there, and I probably was, but there was a young man there whose father came to AA, and anyway, his son was high, and I was drunk, and we were both hits of the party, I'm sure, and I've got to tell you, his young son is coming up, I think, on 4 years this month. And, you know, they didn't kick me out of that sober Super Bowl party. But, you know, I'd been going to enough AA meetings, and I heard just bits and pieces of what you people said. And I left that sober party that day, and I went home, and I had about a case of that wine, and I started drinking it. And I drank it, and nothing happened. I like those blackouts. I don't like to be accountable and responsible. I want the whole world to go by, you know. I want to crawl into bed, pull the covers up over my head, and wake me if it ever gets better. World out there is not very good right now, and I love those blackouts because I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to function. I don't have to think. I don't have to breathe. I don't have to do anything for anybody else. I'm out. And so I'm drinking that wine that day, and I couldn't go out. Nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. And I polished it all off, too. I drank all that wine that evening, and nothing happened. What's worse, I couldn't even go to sleep now. And I started to stand up, and I can't stand up now because the legs are, they're useless. And I fell into the floor. And I had that moment that Father Leo talks about. If you ever get to hear the chance to hear Father Leo, he talks about that moment, that absolute moment when you know. And I had that moment, and I knew then my drinking was over. It's done. Except the head began to operate real quick, and it said, well, what are you going to do now, Pearl? Now you can't drink, and there's no sense in going to AA because it just don't work. So I don't know what I'm going to do now. But I do know that for the first week since I had started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't go to any of those meetings. Two reasons. I wasn't going to AA anymore because it didn't work. And I couldn't drive. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't function. I couldn't eat. I couldn't hold anything down. And I couldn't move. And about the second day, those people in Alcoholics Anonymous began calling, Pearl, where are you? Pearl, where are you? This one nutty guy called and asked me if I was dead. I just love him. Because, see, he did the one step farther thing, too. You know, I'm not going to answer the phone. I'm not pulling in the mail. I'm not getting the newspaper. I got the house locked up tight, and I'm not going anywhere. And I'm not erasing the messages. Because when nobody's calling, I'm playing them over again. I need to hear your voices out there. On a Thursday morning, I hadn't had a drink now since Sunday, and Thursday morning this guy called, and I thought, you know, I'm just gonna pick up the phone, and whoever's there, I'm just gonna tell him, just to tell everybody, just to leave me alone. Leave me alone and let me die. Because I had begun that desperate prayer, the one that goes, oh God, please let me die, please let me die, oh God, don't let me die. Because that's really what I wanted to have happen. And so it was that crazy guy that called and asked me if I was dead. And I don't know, I have these conversations with people long about this time that last a couple or 3 hours, and I haven't a clue what happened, except one more time I had agreed to do something with somebody because I didn't have anything else to do. And what I had agreed to do was go talk to a counselor. And when he hung up, I knew I was going to split and not be home when he got there to pick me up. And for some reason, my hand picked up the phone, and I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous that lived one block away. And I said, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. And I told him what was happening. And he put his wife on the phone. She's a good member of Al-Anon, too. And I talked to her. And in 2 minutes, my doorbell was ringing. And see, he came over to babysit me so I wouldn't leave till Alan got there. And Alan took me to a hospital. And they called it a tough love hospital. I didn't call it love. I didn't go there to stay. I told him I wasn't going to stay. And 30 days later, I checked out. With 30 days of sobriety. I had a little bit more than 30 days of sobriety. And I wasn't happy in there, and I'd scream at him things like, I checked myself in here, I'll check myself out, you watch me. Until that counselor said to me one day, Pearl, I'll tell you what you do, you go pack your stuff up and you get out. He said, because you not only are never going to get this program, Pearl, but you're a detriment to every other patient we have in here. And I thought, if they want me out of here, I'm staying. And I told him, you can't kick me out of here. My insurance is paying for this. When I left the hospital that day, I called that same guy who babysat me, and he took me home. Because what I told that counselor was, my first stop is the liquor store. I'm 30 days thirsty. I got 30 days sobriety. I haven't had 30 days sobriety in years. And I'm thirsty. I worked up a good thirst. But one more time, I called that guy that took me home, and he took me home. And I had told all those patients what I was going to do, that I was, you know, I was going to go get some champagne. I was going to celebrate my sobriety, and I was going to have a great time. And he took me home, and he just dropped me off. And I sat down in the middle of the living room floor, and I started crying. Until I looked at the calendar and realized it was Wednesday, and I always went to the Wednesday night Ohio Street meeting. So I went. They asked for newcomers, and I glared at them. I'm not too good yet, because when I left that hospital there, they told me they'd see me. I said, no, you won't. I'm out of here, and you're never seeing me again. Watch my dust. And so I left, and then I went to that meeting and didn't stick my hand up as a newcomer, and that felt good. And got up, went to the early morning meeting, and asked for newcomers, and I didn't stick my hand up there either. Because I seen these people, they didn't know where I was. And I swore the guy that took me to the hospital, I made him promise not to tell anybody where I was. And I didn't call my kids. They wanted my kids' telephone numbers. And I didn't want I didn't want one more time to look at the faces of their mom when mom blew it one more time. So I gave him my kids' names, and I made up 3 telephone numbers. I don't know to this day if they ever tried to reach those kids or not. Would have done them any good. They asked for a coffee maker for the Wednesday morning meeting, and I started making coffee. And they asked me if I'd make some of my homemade cookies and bring them to the Wednesday night meeting, and I made my homemade cookies and took them there. And when I went to the Thursday night meeting, the Big Ten speakers meeting, they asked me if I'd make the coffee for that meeting. I started making coffee, and the Rebos group on Friday night, that's sober backwards, the Rebos group on Friday night said they needed a new coffee maker. Would I make the coffee for them? And Saturday night, I go to a place called Thursdays, and the girl who was doing the birthday chips moved, and would I start giving out the chips? So I gave out the chips and went back Sunday morning, and I'm coming up on 10 years, and they still don't trust me with that parachute. But 6 months, they asked me to be the treasurer. My Monday night, my home group, They asked me to pour the coffee. The guy that run that hospital said they needed a big book study on Monday afternoon, and I'm 40 days without a drink. And he said, Pearl, can you come up and just help these guys read the big book on Monday afternoon? And I did it. I don't know why. On Tuesday night, they wanted me to come up and take those women out to a women's meeting. I used to get in a lot of arguments with those women, too. They told me one time, they said, you don't understand, Pearl. We don't want to go. And I said, no, what you don't understand is I don't want to come up here and take you. Now, are you going or not? Yeah, I told you I wasn't too well, too fast after I got sober. But I started going to that hospital and Monday afternoon doing that big book study. And I'm going to all those morning meetings and taking those women Tuesday night to a women's meeting. And another hospital found out that I did a book reading, and so they asked me to come over at their hospital on Wednesday afternoon, and all of a sudden I realized I got 60 days without a drink. I was the last to know it. They were all watching. And about that time my sponsor called me on the phone and she said, Pearl, we're going to get into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to do it now. And I understood now. I understood keep coming back, and I understand now. And I'm grateful that we did it now, because what happened was I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, and it was time. It was time. You know, it was just time to do that stuff. 4 months of sobriety, this young girl asked me to sponsor. I'd been taking her to her meetings, and I told her no. You know, have you ever done something you thought your sponsor was going to be proud of you? I told her no. I said, you know, I've only got 4 months. What we need to do is we need to find someone around here with a lot of sobriety, and I'll help you look. So I went home and called up my sponsor, and I thought, sure, she's going to tell me how brilliant I was. And what she said to me, she said, Pearl, do you know what a sponsor is? And I said, no. Caught one, just don't know what they do. She said, honey, a sponsor takes you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a sponsor takes you through the steps. And anything after that's a bonus. She said, you've been through the big book and you've been through the steps. And you call her up tomorrow and tell you you'd be happy to do it. I called her up and told her I'd do it, and I sure left out the happy part. I called my sponsor about 6 months later, and I said, I need out. This girl is certified nuts. She's calling me 4 and 5 times a day. She's driving me crazy. She's nuts. And Polly told me just to hang in there, that my elevator wasn't all the way to the top yet. I don't know if I did or said anything to help that young lady, but she saved my life, and I know that today. She's still sober. She got reunited with her husband and her 2 little boys, and they bought a house out in Riverside, and they're living happily ever after. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard these people talk about the gifts here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you the kind of person I am. You got some gifts here, I want my share. Hand them over. I want my gifts. I heard the people talking about the new cars, the new house, the new job. Oh, one lady just had a facelift. You know, I mean, all that good stuff. You had some good stuff here, Nay, and I want my part. I want my share. I'm not drinking between meetings anymore. I've done the steps, and I'm a service. I know how to do that deal. I want my gifts. But what I thought I was going to get here and what I've gotten has been 2 different things. Because the first gift you gave me was Frank H. gave me, was the gift of hope. When I was going to those meetings and I was drinking between meetings and I finally had the nerve to say I'm drinking between meetings, he held my hand one day and told me to just keep coming back, that he drank between meetings too. You know, and the next gift you gave me was a gift of love. When I got here, I didn't care about anything. I could have lived, I could have died, you could have lived, you could have died, and I wouldn't have cared. I just didn't care about anything. At our Monday night meeting, we give the people we sponsor a cake. And I gave her a cake. She was 1 year. And I was 1 year and 4 months. I never let her forget that either. And I'm holding the cake, and she's blowing out the candle, and I put the cake down, and I put my arms around her. And I told her I loved her. And the deal was I meant it. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know when it happened. You know, I went from there. The next gift you gave me was a gift of trust. When I got here, I didn't trust anybody. It was my experience that everybody in my life hiked out, left me, abandoned me. And so I did those steps with my sponsor, and I told her, I'm going to share all this stuff with you, but if I ever hear at a meeting Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm splitting. The only time I hear my stuff is when I've told it. And I share it with the girls I sponsor and with anybody that needs it, because that's what you taught me to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got here, and I had been raised in the church. I was one of those people whose family took him to church, and I believed in God. But somewhere along the line, I believed that I had done something that just made him so angry. And I got here, and so you gave me a God. You gave me a God that wasn't angry. I grew up in the Midwest where the God was an angry God. And I found a happy God. I called him Bubba for 3 years, and he didn't mind me doing that. And I talk to him a lot now. And you know, he's just a part of my life. And I found out that I didn't have to go looking for him. You know, tells me that God is deep within, and he's with me all the time, so I don't have to worry about going and looking for him. He's just right here with me wherever I go. And I learned about accountability and responsibility. A year sober, he cut off the alimony, and I had to go to work, and I found out I could do that one too. And I work today. I'm not teaching school, but someone had the patience to teach me about the mortgage business, and so I'm an underwriter auditor. When I left that hospital, too, I got to tell you, the doctor told me I was going to shake the rest of my life, that I had done permanent brain damage. You don't get to be an auditor by having permanent brain damage. And I haven't had the shakes since about 60 days. In fact, the last time I saw that doctor, he always tells me, stick out your hands, Pearl, stick out your hands, Pearl. He can't believe I'm not shaking. He just can't believe it. You know, and the next thing you gave me was you gave me a family. I had one. I had a happy one. I grew up in a happy one. But I told you I gave it away. You know, and if you hear Polly talk, Polly talks about great events, and I love to hear her. And from day one, when I would go with Polly and she would talk about her great events, I thought, you know, Polly is so sweet and wonderful. She deserves great events. But you know what? If I can just stay here sober and not hurt another human being again, that's good enough. That's way good enough. I have 4 grandchildren. When the oldest daughter was born, I went to the hospital, and she was laying in that little crib. She's 12 years old. She just called to tell me she's almost a teenager. Yeah. And she was in that little crib, and I got the shakes, but that's my first granddaughter, and I reached down to pick her up, and my son put his hand out, and he said, Mom, she's sleeping. Why don't you hold her some other time? And I knew what he was saying. He was saying he did not want his drunken mom holding his precious little daughter. I knew that. A year later, they had another child, a little boy, and for JR's first birthday, they planned this birthday party, and I planned to go. I went out, and I got a gift, and I wrapped it beautifully. It was gorgeous, and it sat on my dining room table, but I got up that morning, and I overshot the mark, and I had to call and tell him I had the flu, and I couldn't make it to JR's birthday. Sometime later, my younger son had his older daughter. But on August 2nd, 2 years ago, Patricia Therese was born in a hospital right down the street from me, and just a short ways. And my son called and said, Mom, you got another granddaughter. I've got 3 sons. I love having these granddaughters. I got 3 granddaughters and 1 grandson, and none of them are spoiled. But anyway, he said, would you like to come down and see her? And I said, yes. Yeah. So I went into the hospital, and she's laying in that crib, and all of a sudden, I flashed to when the oldest one was born, and I'm not going to reach down and try to pick this one up. And I can't do that. I don't want to see the look on their face, because I got to tell you, with almost 10 years of sobriety, my children still check the glass of whatever I'm drinking once sometimes. So I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting on the edge of the bed, and finally my son said, would you like to hold her, Mom? Yeah. So he put her in my arms, and I held her, for an hour and a half. On the edge of that bed with no back brace, Patricia weighed 9 pounds and she was heavy. My arms hurt, my back ached, and I'm not putting her down. They may never let me touch her again. And finally Jeffrey said, Mom, why don't you go let her go to bed? You can come down and hold her anytime you want. You see, I was cutting myself short. So now I have some of those great events that Polly talks about, and I swear they rub off just because I'm around her. You know, I have this passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, the night that the police came and got me, they called me because I called somebody on the East Coast and I had threatened suicide that night. And the person they called was my oldest brother. I used to call him a lot at 2:30 in the morning. And my last year of drinking and my first year of sobriety, he called me every single day. He was glad when I got sober. And for my first birthday, he gave me the gift of trusting me that he didn't have to call me anymore. On March 10th of this year, he passed away. I went back and was talking to his sons and his daughter. He has six. And we were talking about our best memories of their dad. And I told them about their dad having me arrested in my own house. And my little niece said, "Well, Aunt Pearl, didn't that make you mad?" I said, "Probably at the time, but how can you be mad at a man who saved your life?" You know, see, so what you gave me back was that family. What you gave me back was more than I ever expected. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor and a privilege to do the things in Alcoholics Anonymous that you allow me to do. Thank you.